One argument that I didn't mention last week because I don't know why, but it had to do with campaigns for marriage to be defined as between one man and one woman. In the legal and political discussions about that topic, this argument has come up. The argument is, if you Christians say that marriage should be one man and one woman, this is unconstitutional for you to say that, because it's trying to force your religion on society. And the Constitution guarantees us freedom of religion. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And so when you say marriage should be one man, one woman, like you Arizonans did in fall of 2008, changing your constitution, this is being challenged in court, saying this is unconstitutional. That's forcing your religion on other people. Who said this? Well, David Boies, one of the most successful lawyers in the United States. He's gone to federal court in California challenging Proposition 8, that ballot measure that limited marriage to one man and one woman. He says, David Boies says, while people may have a genuine religious belief that marriage should be between a man and a woman, the other half of the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, says a majority is not entitled to impose its religious beliefs on a minority. In other words, he's saying even though 52% of Californians voted to define marriage as between one man and one woman, they were wrongly establishing a religion, and the federal government, the federal court system, should overthrow that vote because it's establishing a religion. The Iowa Supreme Court in April 3rd, 2009, just a year ago, decided to impose same-sex marriage on the whole state of Iowa. In their decision, they noted a recent poll showing that 28% of Iowans supported same-sex marriage, 28%. But they imposed it on the whole state anyway. Why? They observed that much of society rejects same-sex marriage due to sincere, deeply ingrained, even fundamental religious belief. But the Iowa Supreme Court said these views should not be taken into account because the Iowa Constitution says the General Assembly shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. In other words, limiting marriage to between one man and one woman is equivalent to establishing a religion. Now, I didn't deal with that argument a couple weeks ago because I didn't get to it, but also because I hadn't thought of an answer to it. Now, I have thought of an answer to it and put these paragraphs in my book. These arguments are wrong because marriage is not a religion. When voters define marriage, they are not establishing a religion. In the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The word religion refers to the church that people attend and support. Religion means being a Baptist or a Catholic or a Presbyterian or a Jew. It doesn't mean being married. These arguments try to make the word religion in the Constitution mean something different from what it always has meant. These arguments make the logical mistake of failing to distinguish the reasons for a law from the content of the law. There were religious reasons behind many of our laws, but these laws do not establish a religion. For instance, all major religions have teaching against stealing, but laws against stealing do not establish a religion. All religions have laws against murder, but laws against murder do not establish a religion. The campaign to abolish slavery in the United States and England was led by many Christians based on their religious convictions, but laws abolishing slavery do not establish a religion. The campaign to end racial discrimination and segregation was led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a Baptist pastor who preached against racial injustice from the Bible. But laws against discrimination and segregation do not establish a religion. If these exclude religion arguments succeed in court, they could soon be applied against evangelicals and Catholics who make quote, religious arguments against abortion. Majority votes to protect unborn children could then be invalidated by saying these voters are establishing a religion. And by such reasoning, all the votes of religious citizens for almost any issue could be found invalid by court decree. This would be the direct opposite of the country our founders established and the direct opposite of what they meant by free exercise of religion. Okay? So if somebody says to you, when you make marriage between a man and a woman, you're imposing your religion on society, you just say, marriage isn't what church you go to. Religion is being a Baptist or a Catholic or a Jew, but being married is not a religion. And that's a kind of a short one-sentence argument that I think stops the argument in its track. Marriage isn't a religion. So that's the answer. Okay. Thank you. Questions on that? Yeah. Felix.
Is there all sorts of precedents from history as far back as it goes of that issue and when there wasn't a religion involved? I mean, as far as general
society. Yeah, as far back as history goes, there are precedents where in many societies that aren't even Christian, marriage is defined between a man and a woman. So it isn't necessary. I mean, just society in general has seen it. Yeah. Yeah, good. That's another good argument, Felix. Thanks. Okay. Can I always repeat the question? Because we've only got one mic working today. Okay, now, I am going to go to another topic right now. Let's see. Let me just read something from a journal, National Review, about 10 days ago. Imagine a drug so powerful it can destroy a family simply by distorting a man's perception of his wife. Picture an addiction so lethal it has the potential to render an entire generation incapable of forming lasting marriages. And an addiction so widespread it produces more annual revenue, $97 billion worldwide annually. More revenue than all the leading technology companies combined. Consider a narcotic so insidious that it evades serious scientific study and legislative action for decades, thriving instead under the ever-expanding banner of the First Amendment. According to an online statistics firm, an estimated 40 million people use this drug on a regular basis. And then she mentions a report from something called the Witherspoon Institute. The report is called The Social Costs of Pornography, just issued, and I've ordered a copy. I haven't received it yet. But this author, an anonymous woman who is a psychologist living in Virginia, says this. The findings of the report on the social costs of pornography hit particularly close to home for me. By his own account, my husband of 13 years and my high school sweetheart was first exposed to pornography around age 10. He viewed it regularly during high school and college, and although he tried hard to stop, he continued to do so throughout the course of our marriage. For the past few years, he had taken to sleeping in the basement, distancing himself from me emotionally and physically. Recently, he began to reject my sexual advances outright, claiming he just didn't feel love for me like he used to. Then one morning around 2 a.m., he called intoxicated from his office to announce that he had developed feelings for someone new. The woman he became involved with was an unemployed alcoholic with bleached blonde hair, heavy makeup. I'm not going to read any further. After this revelation, my husband tried to break off his relationship with this woman, but his remorse was short-lived. Within a few months, he had moved permanently out of the home he shared with me and our five young children. In retrospect, I believe he succumbed to the allure of his secret fantasy life he had been indulging since adolescence. And then she says, I guess I quoted this statistic, she says, an estimated 40 million people, I think she means in the United States, use this drug on a regular basis. That's in a population of 300 million. That's a lot. So I am on now the the last page of chapter 7 outline. Last page of chapter 7. And I'm going to talk about pornography. I had thought about just giving a kind of a 10-minute overview of this topic and going on to the next chapter. But then as I looked at the material, I thought, no, I'd better spend a little more time on this because it is such a harmful and destructive issue in society today. So if you need an outline to chapter 7, hold up your hand. Jack has some, but we're good. Okay, thanks. And the issue is, number one, should governments restrict the production and distribution of pornography? Now, we've got a background. Background is government is established by God for our good. And government is supposed to punish those who do evil and reward those who do good or do right. That's Romans 13. That's 1 Peter 2. That's the general principle for government. And the question is then, is restricting pornography doing good for society, and is it punishing evil? I think it is, and I'm going to try to develop that argument here. First, the biblical teaching. In the Ten Commandments, we have this seventh commandment in Exodus 20, verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. That's the fundamental moral standard that God puts in the Ten Commandments to protect marriage, to protect it against being destroyed or harmed. God has a very high interest in protecting and preserving marriage between one man and one woman. All society is founded on that building block that is prior to government, prior to business, prior to schools, prior to church. Marriage is before everything in creation. So God wants to protect it. A prohibition against sex between unmarried persons is also clear in the Old Testament. I've given some verses there, Exodus 22, 16 to 17, and Deuteronomy 22, 13 to 21. I won't read those. In the New Testament, there are many verses that use the phrase, in modern translations, sexual immorality. The Greek word is porneia. It means sexual intercourse outside of marriage of various kinds, but most commonly for unmarried persons. And in the King James Version, porneia was often translated fornication. We don't use the word fornication very often today, but it means unmarried people sleeping together. And these passages in the New Testament that I've mentioned here talk about this as something contrary to God's moral standards. I'll just read a couple of those passages. Matthew 15, 19. Out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, or you could translate that as fornication. Galatians 5:19. The works of the flesh are evident, sexual immorality or fornication, and that's included in a list that has idolatry and drunkenness and other kinds of sin. Ephesians 5:3, sexual immorality, or we could say fornication, and all impurity or covetousness must not be named among you. And there are other passages that speak about that as well. Now, here comes the really challenging part. And some people hear this and they say, this is impossible. I can't believe that the Bible has standards like this. But I want to argue that we should be glad that the Bible has standards like this. Here is the next section. God is concerned not merely with human actions, but also with the attitudes of our heart. We find this in the Ten Commandments, because the last commandment, after saying, you know, honor your father and your mother, and you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, those are all actions. Then the very last one, God speaks to people's hearts because he says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. In other words, it's not enough just to refrain from stealing your neighbor's house or donkey or ox. You can't want to steal it. Your attitude of heart has to be pure. And it isn't enough not to commit adultery with your neighbor's wife. You can't want to commit adultery with your neighbor's wife. Your heart has to be pure. And there are other passages like that. Proverbs 6:25, talking about an immoral woman. And the father's advice to the son is, do not desire her beauty in your heart. Or Matthew 5, Jesus said this, you have heard that it was said you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, now he's going to the deeper meaning of the law. Everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, I think that many people, I mean, I was in an auto repair shop getting my car fixed one day, and I was just kind of waiting for the car to be done. And for some reason, there was a radio with a Christian preacher on in the auto repair shop, and the pastor was reading this verse, and the mechanic just said, that's impossible. I mean, he just shouted it out. I didn't even know him, but he just... When I heard him say it, I thought, that's the reaction of a lot of people. The Bible standards are impossible. Well, number one, that's to make us realize, of course, that we can't live up to God's standards. We need forgiveness in Jesus Christ because we're never by ourselves going to be good enough. We all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. The wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord. But the second thing is, God's moral standards tell us what kind of people we're going to be with in heaven. And you don't want in heaven people who have all sorts of evil thoughts in their hearts. You don't want in heaven people who are jealous and bitter and resentful and want to steal things from you, even if they don't steal them, and hate you because they want to murder you. Or have lust, sexual lust that's wrongful. You don't want people in heaven whose hearts are impure, in other words, is the point I'm making. And in fact, in the fellowship of the church, don't you want to come into the fellowship of a church where people are certainly growing in their moral purity and in the attitudes of their hearts? I think there is a sense of purity that God can give to us that we grow in. But this is God's standard. Anyway, he wants us not just not to violate the faithfulness of marriage, but not to want to violate it. And then there's one passage in the prophet Ezekiel in the Old Testament that talks about how looking at pictures on the wall leads to sexual sin. And it's an allegory. It's a picture of two sisters called Oholah and Oholibah. And one stands for the northern kingdom, Samaria, or Israel, and one stands for the southern kingdom, Jerusalem, the center of kingdom of Judah. And Oholibah is standing for Jerusalem. And what is true about Oholibah? After some very graphic and explicit descriptions of the pictures of the Babylonian or Chaldean soldiers that are described in Ezekiel 23. I won't read it, but you can read it for yourself. And then Oholibah carried her whoring further. She saw, so that's step number one, she saw men portrayed on the wall, the images of the Chaldeans or Babylonians, portrayed in vermilion, kind of red, wearing belts on their waists with flowing turbans on their heads, all of them having the appearance of officers, a likeness of Babylonians whose native land was Chaldea. And other sections in Ezekiel 23, it describes actually these were fairly sexually explicit images. When she saw them, she lusted after them. That's step two. Number one is seeing. Number two is longing for them with a sexual longing. She lusted after them, and she sent messengers to them in Chaldea, and the Babylonians came to her in the bed of love, and they defiled her with their whoring lust. After she was defiled by them, she turned from them in disgust. Ezekiel 23:14-17. So even in the ancient world, there's a recognition that visual images can arouse sexual desire that lead actually to sinful actions. Conclusion, God's moral standards require that people avoid longing for sexual intercourse with someone apart from being married to that person. And my conclusion then from a stand, not yet from a legal standpoint, but from a standpoint of moral standards, is it's morally wrong to create, distribute, acquire, and view photographs, videos, written material, or audio material whose primary purpose is to arouse in people sexual desires that are contrary to God's moral standards. That's the argument from the Bible. Then we go number two, or number three, argument from reason and experience apart from the Bible. What are the results of someone looking at pornography? Pornography attracts a person's affections and desires outside of his or her marriage and away from his wife or husband. So if I'm, now Margaret is sitting right here at the front. If I'm looking at pornography, that's attracting sexual desires that I should have for Margaret away from Margaret toward someone else or something else. And just from a common sense standpoint, that's not where God wants my sexual desires to be directed. Away from my wife. They want my sexual desires to be directed to my wife, who has a smile on her face at the moment. Which makes me happy, actually. Wayne, stop talking. All right. Yeah, she usually sits in the back row. It's a little easier. Okay. Evidence from sociological studies is also available showing the harmful effects of pornography on those who view it and those who are subsequently harmed by these people. And in fact, there are many negative ramifications of pornography on communities. And I'm going to just read some conclusions from a report put out by the National Coalition for the Protection of Children and Families called The Effects of Pornography and Sexual Messages. Young people growing up in... I'll back up. Pornography is often viewed in secret. It creates deception within marriages. It can lead to divorce. It promotes the allure of adultery, prostitution, and unreal expectation that can result in dangerous, promiscuous behavior. Basically, it's saying people who view pornography become more and more isolated from ordinary interaction with other people that they should be involved with, and can lead to adultery, rape, and sexual violence of all sorts of kinds. So here's a quotation. Young people growing up in our already overly sexualized culture are being exposed to sexually explicit material on a daily basis through television, movies, music, and the internet. Children are being subjected to sexual material and messages before they are mentally prepared to understand or evaluate what they are doing. And the majority of sex education is taking place in the media, not in the home, church, or school. False messages are sent by our culture. Message number one, sex with anyone, under any circumstances, in any way it's desired, is beneficial and doesn't have negative consequences. That's a lie. Women have one value, to meet the sexual demands of men. That's a lie. Marriage and children are obstacles to sexual fulfillment. That's a lie. Everyone is involved. Everybody's doing it, in other words. Everybody is involved in promiscuous sexual activity, infidelity, and premarital sex. That's a lie. The pornography industry and the mainstream media are filling consumers' heads with these false beliefs and attitudes. But studies have found that pornography can be highly addictive. Dr. Victor Klein, an expert on sexual addiction, found a four-step progression. Number one, addiction. Two, escalation. Over time, addicts require more explicit and deviant material. Number three, desensitization. What they first perceived as gross, shocking, or disturbing in time becomes common. And then fourth, acting out sexually, acting out the sexual behavior in harmful ways to others. Sexually oriented businesses such as strip clubs, attract crime to communities and provide increase in molestation of children. In Phoenix, this is a national report, but it quotes a Phoenix study. A Phoenix neighborhood where adult businesses were located, the number of sex offenses was 506% greater than in areas without such businesses. Number of property crimes was 46% greater. So, child and adult pornography is frequently used by pedophiles to lure children. Do you see the picture of just a cancer eating away at our society, silently, secretly, hidden, but just destroying life after life? Alan Sears, who has spoken in this class, president of Alliance Defense Fund. Alan Sears, I don't know if you know this, he was a federal prosecutor. And then he, when President Reagan was president, under Attorney General Ed Meese, Alan Sears headed up the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography. And Alan Sears says, the sexual union within marriage is a picture of supreme selflessness. It is meant by the Creator to be an act of supreme love, giving, and unity. But virtually all advocates of secular sexual behavior center on it's all about me philosophy rather than love and care for the other partner. In years of public speaking about this issue, I have repeatedly referred to pornography as the true hate literature of our age because of its hatred and exploitation of the human person. It reduces human beings to valueless commodities to be ogled at and disposed of like used tissue. So, what should government do? This brings us to number four, the conclusion about laws. What laws should governments make regarding pornography? I think government should make laws against the production and distribution and sale of pornographic materials. Why? Because it has a harmful effect on the moral standards of society and on the people who use it and on others. Because of its harm to society, in other words, I think governments should try to prevent pornography. Now, people will say, well, wait a minute, doesn't the First Amendment protect freedom of the press? And doesn't freedom of the press mean I can publish anything I want to? No, it doesn't. Courts have repeatedly held that you can't publish slander or libel. You can be sued for that and punished. You can't publish incitement to riot. You can't publish consumer fraud or mail fraud. You don't have any First Amendment right to do that. And so here, the courts have repeatedly said that obscene material is not protected by the First Amendment. So, there are two standards that are referred to in two Supreme Court decisions. In 1957, there was a standard in Roth v. the United States. The standard is this: whether to the average person applying contemporary community standards, the dominant theme of the material taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest. Now, the problem is if you're not a lawyer, you don't know the meaning of the word prurient. I can hardly say it, but I looked it up. It means inordinately interested in matters of sex. So to the average person, does the material as a whole appeal to inordinate interest in sex? And then a more recent standard that's more frequently referred to, called the SLAPS test, S-L-A-P-S. A work is not considered obscene unless it lacks serious literary, artistic, political, and scientific value. Now, I talked to Alan Sears about this when I was working on this chapter, because I had thought, you know what? These pornographers get high-priced lawyers who come in and say that all sorts of garbage, pornographic garbage, has serious literary value. And they get some expert to be paid to say that. Or it has serious artistic value. Isn't this a wonderful work of art? But Alan Sears' response was, as long as juries are allowed to give a common sense meaning to the word serious, this standard works just fine. and you can get conviction after conviction. So I was surprised and I was encouraged about that. It has to have serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. And he said, prosecutors can win verdict after verdict as long as judges don't talk juries into some very strange view of serious, meaning you get some strange eccentric expert to testify to it or something like that. But if a jury can have a common sense meaning of serious, the standard works. So why do we still have ongoing pornography in the United States? The ongoing problem is not that the laws are inadequate, but that the prosecutors are not willing to bring charges against those who produce and distribute pornography. So now, again, depending on my conversation with Alan Sears, he said, probably it would be best if prosecutors focused only on pictures, not on words. Because you get these, you know, court cases in some small town in the deep south that's tried to rule out some work of literature, Catcher in the Rye or Lady Chatterley's Lover, that has pornographic material in it. And then people, I suppose with reason, can say, oh, these are literary standards and people should be allowed to read those, and then they lose in court. And so words are harder to prosecute, is the point. But pictures are easier to prosecute, and that's where most of the damage comes. So Alan Sears said, if prosecutors focus on pictures, that is, printed pictures and videos, then the laws now are sufficient to win convictions. So what happened? Under President Reagan, 1981 to 1989, and then the next president, President George H.W. Bush, 1989 to 93, so that's 12 years. Federal prosecutors were highly successful in prosecuting and winning convictions against numerous pornographers in the United States. Under the leadership of Patrick Truman, chief of the Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section of the Department of Justice, there were multiple prosecutions, 50 individual or corporate convictions of sending obscene material through the mails, a Los Angeles project that led to the conviction of 20 out of 50 producers and suppliers of obscene material in the Los Angeles area. Reuben Sturman, the nation's largest distributor of pornographic material, was convicted in 1992. In other words, there was 12 years of progress in shutting down the whole pornography industry in the United States. But once President Clinton took office, according to Patrick Truman, the chief of this Department of Justice office, once President Clinton took office, the Democratic administration, quote, all but halted obscenity prosecutions. That was under Janet Reno as Attorney General, deciding it would focus instead on child pornography, which meant they ignored adult obscenity prosecutions. When George W. Bush became president in 2001, there was some return to an emphasis on prosecuting pornographers, with Attorney General Ashcroft and Gonzalez, but it was not as great as Reagan's Justice Department or that of President George H.W. Bush. ABA Journal article concludes, the real reason internet obscenity has not been tackled stems from the fact that law enforcement seems not to have the time, resources, or inclination to pursue it. Okay, good. Thank you, Jack. Okay. Thank you. This is Jack's official role in our class. Those of you who don't know, he's to keep me on time. And so he's right. So this is meaning I have 5 minutes to conclude. So what did I want to say? There are moral standards in the Bible that seem to me clearly violated by pornography. It seems to me a legitimate purpose of government to have laws against pornography, defined even as in these Supreme Court decisions. And our laws are, according to Alan Sears, who headed up this pornography commission under the Attorney General's office, the laws are adequate to bring convictions and to stop pornography. It's just that our leaders lack the political will or lack the pressure from the general public to really bring a stop to this problem in the United States and to the immense damage that it does to marriages. I think what I wanted to do was, I want to say one more thing. I have 200 people here. Just statistics being what they are, I suppose there are people here who have either whose marriages have been troubled by pornography or who are themselves troubled by pornography. And I want to say that Scottsdale Bible Church has resources for helping people to deal with this. And Wayne Leaston, who has now retired from full-time heading up our counseling ministry here at the church, but Wayne is here and is familiar with this, and I thought I would just, in conclusion, ask Wayne to say something about what resources are available. JT, is that mic working now? We'll see if it's not. What resources are available in Scottsdale Bible Church?
We do have a great resource in our counseling center. When I was working, we had support groups for many men who were struggling, Christian men who were struggling in the area of getting out of pornography and having victory over it. One of the greatest resources that I found years ago was a book called False Intimacy. And I can't recall the author's name. I'm at that age where I forget names. But if you Google that, you'll come up with a great resource, False Intimacy. And I guess I'd want to stress that I support everything you said, Wayne, because what it is really a deception by the enemy, deceiving men to think that they're going to find intimacy with pictures. And all it does is leads them into a further addiction and greater involvement in sexual issues than can be satisfied by looking at pornography. So,
And when it never does bring the satisfaction or the joy that people are seeking.
No,
does it
destroys it, of course, in the marriage, yeah. And we've dealt with it. We had a retreat 10 or 15 years ago. It was a small men's retreat, and we had each of the men answer the question, how many of you have been involved in looking at pornography in the last week or month? I forget what it was. And 33% of our Christian men at that small retreat indicated that they had been had looked at pornography that week. So it's a serious problem, and it's gotten worse in the last 15 or 20 years.
It's like alcoholism or drug addiction or
it's
gambling.
An addiction.
That is, I think Satan is the liar and the father of lies. He disguises himself as an angel of light.
Absolutely.
Makes people think there's going to be joy in pornography, in drug addiction, in alcoholism, in gambling, but there isn't.
Absolutely. Dr. Greg Crow was interviewed. He's a member of our church. He plays in our orchestra, PhD psychologist, this past week on Channel 12 because of all of the talk about Tiger Woods and his addiction.
Yeah.
And Dr. Crow has written a book on this subject as well.
Okay.
And it's a real serious problem.
And did you say it's been increasing?
Absolutely, exponentially. I think it's on the increase tremendously.
Yeah, because of availability in the Internet.
Yes.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
Okay, that was all I had to say. I thought John over here, John Blackman.
Just the interview between Jim Dobson and Ted Bundy is very revealing.
Who was Ted Bundy?
Mass murderer,
serial killer, and the interview that James Dobson had with him before his execution in Florida, he pointed to addiction to pornography that started him along the road to becoming a mass murderer, serial killer. Okay, thanks, John. Very sobering. Way in the back, Don. Don, are you heading up the marriage ministry here at Scottsdale Bible now? Yes, okay.
There was a very interesting article last year in Christianity Today that said 70% of men, Christian men, have looked at pornography in the last 30 days. And I forget what the standard was or what the number was for women, but it was exceptionally high.
Mm-hmm.
When we did the marriage survey December, January of this year, we got 590 people who responded. 10% said that they had dabbled with it or had an occasional use with it. And we know that's wrong. If the standard in America or if this what's going on in America is 70% are Christian men and only 10 are identifying it, then we have a very hidden problem, and that's the scary part, because it hasn't been brought out.
But also, Don, I would expect that the percentage would be lower at Scottsdale Bible Church than for the general public. And these surveys of churches take into account people who go once a year to a church. And so I'm not saying there's no problem here, because I'm sure there is. I would hope that it's less than in society at large. Yeah. Okay. Other comments and questions? Rose? Yeah.
I'm concerned about pornography walking around all day long. My grandkids, my grandsons, the way the girls are dressing, and some of their parents.
Yeah.
I just think it's terrible.
Okay. So, opportunity for Christian parents to teach modesty to their children. You know what? I'm going to call on Julie. What did you teach your daughters, Julie? Because I know you have brought up some godly young women.
We have boys and girls, and I think you approach both of them very differently on this issue. I mean, you address the girls in regard to modesty and how they're dressing and not dressing to attract a boy's sexual attention, and that's very challenging to do. You have to shop differently, you have to look at yourself differently, and you have to say, what am I communicating about myself and about my Savior in the way that I dress? With the boys, you know, that's a whole other challenge, and I would defer that to Ron, because that's mostly his, that he deals with the boys.
Go ahead.
Thanks.
Yeah. You teach respect. I mean, you teach, above all, I think, like Julie said, what do you communicate about yourself and about your Savior? But you have to teach your sons respect and live it out in my life to respect my wife and tell them how to avoid evil and to stay out of situations that would cause compromise.
Yeah.
So as far as access to pornography, I mean, my sons at age 12 told me that the kid down the street, when they go to his house, he's just got magazines all over the place.
Wow.
And his father knows it. And
wow.
So open communications. You have to realize at an early age that they're going to have access to things. And if they're coming home and telling you that, then at least you know you've got a little teachable moment. You've got inroads. So keep the communications open. Keep the filtering software on your computers and watch what they're doing.
Good. Good. Excellent. Thank you, Ron. Okay, Rose up here, and then over in the back, I see one. If we keep this set up, we're going to have to buy two or three more of these roving mics.
I just wanted to comment that Scottsdale Bible is kind of a paradox of people and of preaching. These two ladies made some very important points about the way that the women dress at the church. It's not, as far as I'm concerned, it's not brought up by the women's ministry administration. Also, the young girls, if you come on the night when it's children's night, you'll see these girls. They look like little mini prostitutes. And they're on campus. And even when I take my granddaughter, once in a while I bring her to church here, the girls who are taking care of her, they are like,
okay.
You know, with the mini shorts.
Okay.
And
okay.
I challenge them.
Yeah.
And even the girls who check in the children are dressed for attention. So why is it that this issue is not brought up at the pulpit.
Okay. Or maybe at the management level of family ministry and things like that. Now, we do have a new, brand new family ministry pastor and his wife who are really wonderful people. And maybe, Rose, just the fact that you're bringing this up could be an impetus for causing some examination of that question, or maybe something you need the elder board to talk about. So thanks. Way over here in the back, I don't know your name.
My name is Tom Compton. Yep. It seems to me that television provides purveyors of precursors for pornography, if not actually pornography. How do we regulate that? I think the easiest way is the OFF button, and people have lost that control and responsibility to their children.
Okay.
Getting things like Rose was talking about happening because they see this on TV.
Okay. Tom, just an excellent question. My hope is that by talking about this today, people here will at least be encouraged not to buy from advertisers that promote sexually explicit material on television. Just say, you know, if I see that in an advertisement, that's exactly the product I am not going to buy. And if, in fact, our culture, our society, through the influence of the church, is transformed so enough people start doing that, then I think we can have, there is a way to influence media, and that is through dollars, or through not dollars, that is, not spending. You know, probably 15 years ago, I think Kmart was the largest retailer, maybe 20 years ago, Kmart was the largest retailer in the United States. And I think it was Don Wildman, the American Family Council in Mississippi, said they did research and they found that the largest purveyor of pornography in the United States was Kmart through its Circle K, I think it was through its Circle K subsidiary stores. And they called for a national boycott of Kmart. And I've got a little graph at home that tracks the stock price of Kmart from the time that boycott started. And eventually, and Kmart, when it heard about that boycott, it said, we're not going to do anything. This is what consumers want. So they refused to respond to it. And Kmart stock went down, down, down. And Kmart eventually declared bankruptcy. So concerted effort by people in the United States against key influencers of the culture, I think, can have an effect if it's done carefully and wisely. So thanks for that. Okay. We have two more questions we can sing and we're out of here. Or two more comments if we have any. Otherwise, we can just sing. Yeah. Go ahead. Right here. Yeah. What's your name?
Hi, my name's John.
What's your name?
John.
John.
Yes. Just a quick question. Are there any concerns that you didn't really address them about giving the federal government or asking the federal government to take so much control over what they view as pornography to where they can regulate what is considered too pornographic for ads or what have you, where now it's whether it's verbiage or a picture of maybe from one end of people holding hands to you know what we see now. I mean, it's are there concerns about taking that route versus like what we're talking about in this latter half of this conversation of being, hey, let's as a group go out and try and fight this as individuals or a Christian community.
I am always concerned about the growth of federal government power. Much of this is done at the state and local level. It's done at the Scottsdale City Council level. And it's done at the Maricopa County level. And so a lot of it is local. As far as federal government, when we have national broadcasting, I think the only regulator of that can be the federal government. And I think that's just probably a good role, a role that government has to have. So, okay, anything else? John? No. Dan Carroll. Yeah. What's your last name?
Smith.
Dan Smith. Okay.
Every morning, while shaving, I listen to the Laura Ingraham show.
Yeah.
Good show. You can get kind of depressed if you listen to it every day. But I enjoy listening to it. But About 3 weeks ago, I heard an advertisement that I could not believe on her show. It was from a dating service called Ashley Madison. It was a website. It's a dating service for people that are currently married but looking for something on the side.
Are you kidding?
I could not believe it. When I first heard it, I thought it was a joke. But I have heard it repeatedly since then, and I got on her website.
What radio network is this?
This is, whatever it is, it's around 1100. I don't know the name of the radio station.
Wow.
But, I got on Laura Ingram's website,
yeah,
and there's a place to write comments,
yeah,
about advertisements.
Yeah.
And I wrote on there, I put an email on there that I could not believe what I had heard, and I could not believe
and?
That she would continue
any response?
Having someone advertise. I did not hear any response.
The place to get a response is not from Laura Ingram, maybe, but from the manager of the radio,
yeah,
station.
You're right. I probably should,
yeah,
email them.
Okay.
Just
thanks.
Thought I would mention
thanks,
that.
Dan. Okay, let's, I know this is not like your spiritually edifying, uplifting, enjoyable Sunday morning presentation. It just is not. But we're going through laws concerning marriage, and as we go through laws, it has to do with evil as well in society. So I thought it was probably right that we deal with this. But what's the response when we're discouraged about things in society, and we're discouraged about trends and things in government? I think the response is to pray. And certainly, here's an old hymn that we sang a couple weeks ago, but I thought we'll go back to this hymn and sing it once again, What a Friend We Have in Jesus.